I told my wife there's absolutely no way in the world I was going to Grace. It actually took three of our neighbors that live in our subdivision coming to invite us on different occasions that we finally said, all right, we'll give it a shot. And I sustained an injury at my place of employment, and I broke every bone in my right arm. People at Grace immediately started surrounding me and my family. Started providing meals, started providing love, encouragement, prayers. Through that is where it really started, not just my physical recovery, but my spiritual recovery as well. We had been to churches that we felt like they were just giving us feel-good sermons, to where they were just telling us what we wanted to hear, that everything's happy-go-lucky, when we knew in all reality it wasn't. To actually get biblical truth and to have Matt and Bill and the other pastors challenge us and even possibly wound us and open up those wounds for us to have to deal with and bring it to the surface was powerful. And this is a church where we could see ourselves growing and our family growing.
Through Grace, I've realized that my life is not mine, and my brokenness that I've had is not mine either. God has shown me that with all of that, I am to do His work.
God came here as a man and served us when we didn't deserve it. Through the outreach the church has done for me personally, not just our family. And that's helped me to understand that this life isn't about me. The true meaning of living out God's word and applying it to our lives isn't just for us. It's for us to reach out into the community beyond our own walls of our homes, of the church, and love on other people and serve other people just like Christ served us.
Right, I want to thank Brandon and Miranda for sharing their story, but I do want to take issue. I'm very happy-go-lucky. 9 out of 10 people in our church think I'm very happy-go-lucky. He said that in the beginning. I thought it was funny. I might be the only one. He did say, you didn't see this in the uncut portion of the video. One of the things he said was, I heard Matt. I looked at the website, saw Matt. I do this little introductory video on our website. It's pretty terrible. But he goes, I saw that, and I was like, I'm never going to that church. They cut that part out. I just thought I'd add it back. You don't ever know what God's doing in people's lives. You don't know the journey that they're on. You do not understand or can comprehend the path that so many different people are on as God draws people to Himself and integrates them into the flow of what He's doing, not just in our local church, but any other local church. It's fascinating. And just moving from skepticism, as you heard in His voice, all the way to serving, starting to give their lives away for other people, and not just in the context of our church, but in the community too. So it's a very powerful thing. We came here 20 years ago, and the idea of planting a church, you have one filter, one grid that you're working off of, and is that we want to see people's lives change. And so as people's lives change, then you say, okay, this is what we're doing. It's what we're supposed to be doing. And here's what I would say. After 20 years, a lot changes, and then some things don't change. And one of the things that does not change is that grid is still there of trying to say, what are the things that we do as a church on a weekend service, but then during the week, around the world, that help bring about life change for people? It used to just be in our context. Now we look at how do we bring that about in other contexts too. So it's more than I could have ever anticipated. I mean, I could not have dreamt 1/10 of what God has decided to do through this local body, whether that's on Sunday morning in a weekend service or through worship and teaching and instruction with children and students, or is it Tuesday at lunch with someone who feels equipped to be able to share their story and to be able to ask great questions of someone else who does not know who Christ is, and to be able to move that conversation along. Whether that's in Anderson or Nicaragua, whether it's a small group of students at Harrison Bridge or a small group of pastors in Frankfurt, Germany. I mean, who knows? Right? That's the work that God's given us to do, whether we're dealing with Latinos in the upstate or now Indians in the upstate. Whether it's a single mom in Spartanburg or meals and a backpack and some clothes for a child in Easley. So we get to this time of the year and we share the story, and we're going to share the next few weeks some of the things that God's been doing this past year to let you know, as we get to the end of the year, it's a good time to give. And so for some of you, you wait till the end of the year to be able to give significantly. We really appreciate that. We think this is as good a spiritual investment as you're going to get. But one of the things that's most powerful for our church is when people who do not give say, I'm just going to start giving. It may not be $500 a month, it might be $20 a month, $50 a month, $100 a month. When they just start giving consistently and they bring what they have and then they see God's faithfulness, then our church is built on that. We are not built off of a few givers at the end of the year who write big checks, as great as that is. We are built off of thousands of people who just give their five loaves, their two fish, and God multiplies it. And so we're grateful for it. 2 Corinthians 8:7. It says this, since you excel in so many ways, in your faith, your gifted speakers, your knowledge, your enthusiasm, your love for us, he goes, I want you to excel also in this gracious act of giving. Sometimes guys like me will not talk about giving because we don't see it as all these other things. There are all these things as a church and as individuals that we need to be disciplined around moving on and being obedient in, and giving is one of those. So I want to encourage you to do that. So you pray and see what God would have you do. What does it mean for you to be a faithful part of our body? All right, turn to Esther chapter 9, right around page 301, 302, somewhere in there. 302, I think. Turn there. As I finish the book, chapters 9 and 10. 10's a short chapter, so we won't be here long. I got you. You got things to do on the weekend, right? So we are gonna have a chance to study God's word and to be able to respond with some singing. The recap is, if you've missed the book, you might want to read it. Go back and listen to some of the sermons. You can kind of get the idea of what's been happening. But it's like the show or the movie that you go see that has two endings. Something dramatic happens that brings resolution to this tension in the story, and this major villain is taken out of the way, and then you realize, oh no, that villain's taken out of the way, and that felt really good for like 2 seconds, but now we realize that villain turned on a bomb or something in the thing, and we're all going to blow up, so now we didn't just have to dismantle the villain, now we have to dismantle the bomb. Well, in the story of Esther, the villain's Haman, who set some things in motion, and the bomb he set in motion was an edict to destroy the nation Israel, to wipe out all of these Jews. So though he's been removed, he's been hanged or impaled on his own pole in his backyard. And everything that he has gone to Mordecai. So justice has been brought about towards Haman, but he's still got this bomb that's ticking, this thing that he set in motion that's got to be dealt with. And so last week, what we saw, wherever campus you were on, we had different teachers teaching, is that a second decree was put in motion because you can't reverse the first one. You can't undo it. So you have to add a second decree, which empowers the Jews to be able to defend themselves. So we can't reverse the first decree and say it didn't happen. So what we can do is empower the Jews to be able to take care of themselves and fight for themselves. So we're going to see some violent justice. We're going to see some graphic justice, and we're going to see celebration over that justice, which raises great questions about why, some of which I might attempt to answer. Others will leave in tension for a little while longer, but let's just start in verse 1, chapter 9. So on March 7, the two decrees of the king were put into effect. One, Jews can die today. Second decree, Jews can defend themselves. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but quite the opposite happened. The Hebrew word is the word overturned. So you thought it was going in one direction, but then there was an overturning and it went in a different direction. So quite the NLT translates it, quite the opposite happened. So, but it is an overturning. It was the Jews who overpowered their enemies. Verse 2, the Jews gathered in their cities throughout the king's provinces to attack anyone who tried to what? Underline this, harm them. So what are they doing? Defense. It's a defensive posture. Now, I'm not taking anything away from it. They're going to be brutal, okay? I'm not trying to minimize what happens here. But notice, they band together in a defensive posture to protect themselves from anyone who tried to harm them. But no one could make a stand against them, for everyone was afraid of them. And all the nobles in the provinces, the highest officers, the governors, the royal officials, helped the Jews for fear of Mordecai. Mordecai has been on the rise. This one who was going to be killed by Haman. Now the roles reversed. Haman's died. Mordecai's on the rise. And so there's a name, there's a reputation. For Mordecai had been promoted in the king's palace and his fame spread throughout the provinces. He had become more and more powerful. More and more great is how it really reads. He became more and more great. I used to get marked down for writing like that. It's a radical reversal. We've seen it in Esther's life, where she comes from to be queen. We've seen it in Haman's life. From where he goes, he falls. Mordecai, he was low, he's exalted. So the people who were condemned have now been vindicated in a sense. All right? So there's been this radical reversal, and it leaves you with the question of that you get to bring to the story of how? How is it in a world of logic and reason when everything is lined up, A plus B equals C, how come it's A plus B does not equal C? It equals something that we never anticipated. It's supposed to point you to the fact in a world of logic and reason where things sometimes look random. It's not random at all. God caused this reversal. That you could not have predicted the future. You could not have predicted what happened because God caused that. And the readers, 100 years, 200 years after this, after these events, they get to pick up this book that does not mention God's name. And they get to bring God to the story, which is what you get to do. You get to bring God to the story. Not just this story, but your own story. So we had moved to Greenville, or moved to Easley 19 years ago, 20 years ago. And we got around to Christmas time, and there was I can't quite remember, but it was a medical bill, and there was two kinds of insurance due, and we had bought a house. And how in the world the bank approved a church planter to get a house? I'm still trying to research that. It's probably what caused the big collapse. I don't know. And so we had two small children. The second one I insisted on. I mean, I insisted we have another child. So we had two small children, and we have no money, and have two insurance and medical bill and all this. And so I was like, Lord, look at what I did. I've created this thing. We're in a hole. We're going to collapse. And Christmas. And so I got a phone call from a guy who said, hey, Matt, I got a job for you. And he subcontracted some work to me for Michelin, actually, their test track. And he goes, we drove out there. He goes, you want to do this job? I striped parking lots at the time, kind of at night, and did church stuff during the day. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. He goes, okay. I said, I don't know what the price is. He goes, price is already set. It's $1,500. I was like, $1,500? It's like a lottery. Like you go work a couple days and you win the lottery. I mean, I can't even tell you how much money that was to me. And then like within 24 hours, this guy calls me. He goes, hey, I need to see you for a few minutes. I'm headed out of town. Meet me wherever, Waffle House. So we met. He goes, hey, I got up yesterday morning. I was praying and I felt like God told me to write you this check. He goes, I feel like I have a gift of giving. I don't ever know what it is. I usually don't know what it is, but I just felt like this is what he told me. It was $300. And the most recent bill I had gotten was $300. And so in 24 hours, I go from being like, how are we going to survive, to $1,800, just like that. And I'm driving back home, and I'm thinking to myself, it's so overwhelming and emotional. God, look what you did for me. Look what you did. And then I had this feeling like God saying, and you're going to forget. And you're totally going to forget. In 2 weeks, you're going to be like, yeah, well, I work hard. Or look at the great people I'm training in my church. And how they're generous they are. I mean, he goes, in 2 weeks, Matt, you're going to twist this all around where it's just random or you get the credit. You're going to forget. And I tried to mark it down and say, God, I'm never going to forget that in that moment it was so real to me that that's what you did for me. I'm going to try to never. And so in my office, for those people who work with me or know me, I have trinkets everywhere. I have all kinds of little trinkets. And if you say, hey, what's that from? It marks something that happened. And it can be obscure. Where this building sits on Pelham Road, this used to be a parking lot. And so I have a piece of the asphalt from that. When they tore that parking lot up to build this building, I kept a piece of that asphalt. Because I'm like, oh, that's asphalt that was given to us. 5 acres in a building given to us. Boom, got that. Never going to forget. That happened. And so what you get to do is you either get to forget or rationalize away what God does in your life. Or you get to say, you know what? I'm going to stand on this idea that this is not just a cold world where things happen by chance all the time, that God is working. He doesn't always do what I want, the way I want, when I want, but there are reversals. And when you see a reversal, it's supposed to spark your imagination that just maybe there's a God somewhere who is working on your behalf, that he sees and that he knows. Verse 5. So the Jews went ahead on the appointed day, it's where it gets tough, and struck down their enemies with a sword. They killed and annihilated their enemies and did as they pleased to those who what? Who loved them? They're picking on people? No, to those who hated them. In the fortress of Susa itself, the Jews killed 500 men. What is this? It's not indiscriminate. It is retaliation. It is retaliation for the threat that was brought to them. You're like, well, I just think they need to handle that a different way. You know what they could do? They could have Nikki Haley bring in the National Guard. No, wait, they don't have that. You're on your own. They're not given the opportunity to have someone protect them. They're given the opportunity to protect themselves, which is what they do. Verse 13, Esther responded. And so they've had this day where they fought their enemies. And you're like, whew, glad that day's over. Then in verse 13, she says, hey, I got another question. If it pleased the king, give the Jews in Susa permission to do it again tomorrow. We had a good day of fighting, but we need one more day. Why? Because the threat's still out there. There's still people, because the concentration here was higher, maybe. There's still people here who want to threaten us. And then there are the descendants of Haman. And they have not forgotten and they will not forget what was set in motion and what their dad wanted to do and the reversal. And they're going to want vengeance. So we want to do it again tomorrow, as they have done today. Let the bodies of Haman's 10 sons be impaled on a pole. So the king agreed, and the decree was announced in Susa, and they impaled the bodies of Haman's 10 sons. Then the Jews at Susa gathered together on March 8th and they killed 300 more men. But notice this, and it's already been said once and we missed it, but he goes, and they took no plunder. Why? Because they want you to know this is not about conquest. This is about survival. This isn't about us. We're going to try to make money off this deal. We're going to try to promote ourselves. This is about our lives were threatened. And now we're going to move on day one to remove that threat. And there's still some threat. So we're going to move on day two to make sure that threat is gone. So it's not about conquest. It's about survival. And here's what you know, is that is actually not that different than the world we live in today. And we're finding this out the hard way. We've been finding it out. And now Europe is finding it out. Ironically enough, you would think, you know, World War I, the war to end all wars. World War II, what was the thinking? Surely, all these millions of people have died. Surely we are done with this. We have purged ourselves of all this evil and all this tyranny, and Europe has really bought into that idea. You know what? We got that out of our system. Everybody's going to be fine. And you know what we're finding out now? Everybody does not have that out of their system, and we are not going to be fine. Is that when dudes decide to blow up a building or shoot a bunch of people, you can't say, well, they fled, and so I bet they'll probably never do that again. I think we'll be fine. No, what do? They do 400 or 500 raids, and they go find them because they know this is going to happen again. So evil is present there. Evil's present now. It is an unfortunate reality, and this is part of the life that they're living. And so this is part of the justice that's being brought. This is the reversal for all the people that they were going to kill. This is less, but it is a reversal of what was going to happen. Verse 16. Meanwhile, the other Jews throughout the king's provinces had gathered together to defend their lives. They gained, circle this word, relief. They gained relief from all their enemies. The total is 75,000 people who hated them. But they did not take any plunder. This is going to get said 3 or 4 or 5 times. This is not about raiding a group of people and pillaging. It's not about that. Verse 17. This was done throughout the provinces on March 7th and March 8th. They, circle this word, rested. So in 16, they gained relief. In 17, they rested, celebrating their victory with a day of feasting and gladness. Here's what's interesting. Everywhere else in the scriptures, Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, I mean, there's more, but these are just ones that I've seen. Joshua, the Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, few times in the minor prophets, a couple times in the major prophets. When you see the words relief and rested, it's always associated with what God has given or granted. Except where? Except here. Why? Because this book doesn't do that. This book does not give God credit for anything. Why? Because he's letting us bring that to the table. And so it says, they gained relief in 16 and they rested. And so we get to look at this in that moment and say, okay, this is what God has granted them. This is where rest and relief comes from. And we get to know that and we get to bring it to the table. It does raise this question of judgment, which is tough for us. But let me just do not a ton of technical work. Let me just show you a simple idea about what is going on and why it is difficult and true and it's okay. As difficult as it is. Two sides to judgment. When we talk about the word judgment, it's a technical term. It means krino, cut, separate. And so we're separating two things. Whenever you see judgment, you see two things flowing out of it. You see salvation and you see condemnation. So 75,000 people, 2 days of slaughter, hated them, these people died. What is that? That's condemnation. That's sad. But on the other side of that is the salvation that these Jews experience. And we're talking about whether it's physical or spiritual, same principle, right? The salvation they experience is a cause for joy. So you're like, how are they having joy when these people are suffering? Because this is the nature of judgment. It has a deliverance side and it has a destructive side. It has this part where things go well and it has this other part where things don't go. There's this death, there's this celebration. You go, well, that is an interesting Old Testament principle. If only it were. We could be like, well, that's how those people lived. It is a transcendent idea. It's before time, it's after time, it's all in time. And so Jesus says it like this in Matthew 25. They'll follow along on the slide. You can turn there, verse 31, or you can just follow on the slides. Jesus says this. Chapter 24 of Matthew is all about judgment. Chapter 25, he's piecing all that together. Verse 31, he goes, but when the Son of Man comes in glory, and all the angels come with him. And most angels are suited for battle. That's what most angels look like. So he goes, so when the Son of Man comes in glory and all the angels are with him, he will sit on his glorious throne, 32, and all the nations will be gathered in his presence. And he will do what? He will judge. Or the word is, he will separate. He will separate them. Just like a shepherd, not as a shepherd. It's a metaphor. So it's like or as. It's as one. So as a shepherd separates sheep from goats, he will place the sheep on his right hand, which is the good side, and he'll place the goats on his left hand, which is the bad side. And the passage goes on to describe the reason is they lived a lifestyle that illustrates they do not trust in their Messiah. They lived a lifestyle that was self, for those goats, they lived a lifestyle that was self-oriented, and they were dismissive of the idea of who the Messiah was and what it wanted for them, what it meant for him to trust in God. And so that's why it illustrates the lifestyle, but it's based on what's going on in their soul. So they are separated, and then it goes on to say, and for those sheep, they are brought into glory with their Messiah, and for those goats, they're separated for all eternity into condemnation. So the idea of judgment is not an Old Testament idea. It's a transcendent idea. It's Old Testament, New Testament, and no one is clearer on this than Jesus. So, and it's particularly helpful at this time of the year to get clear because this time of the year has done the most to obscure that idea. Ironically enough, Christmas was supposed to be a celebration of the Messiah to help us gain clarity on who Jesus is, and it's actually ruined a lot of that clarity because it's baby Jesus in a manger brings us gifts, and he hired Santa Claus to do it for him because he's tired. And so he's got Santa Claus delivering gifts to us because that's what Jesus wants to have, gifts from Santa. And there's some bunnies running around at Easter too. I mean, you can't make sense of any of it, right? And at Christmas, Jesus comes. And here's the word. He comes in a manger as a baby. He's what? Accessible. You can get to him. He's a human. He's going to come and live among us. He's going to live under the curse. He's going to die on a cross to pay for sins for all those who put their faith and trust in him. He is accessible to us. In Revelation 1:16, it says he comes back with a sword coming out of his mouth. He is what? Not accessible. Here he sits on, in Matthew 25, he sits on what kind of throne? A glorious throne, one that you don't ascend to. You don't go up and talk to him. You don't drag him off his throne. You don't wrestle with him. He's not accessible to us in that way at that point. And so the accessible Christmas comes back in Revelation, predicted here in Matthew 25. He brings judgment. It's why the cross is so important for us. Because what the cross tells us is that sometime in the future, I am going to pay for my sin. At some point in the future, Jesus is going to sit on a glorious throne and he's going to say, Matt belongs on the right side or the left side. Matt is a sheep or he is a goat. And there's going to be this payment. And for every sin I have ever committed, condemnation is going to fall on me and it's going to separate me from Jesus for all eternity unless that judgment has been prepaid at the cross. Unless I have recognized my need of salvation because the judgment's coming, and I said, you know what? Since judgment, my judgment, fell on Jesus at the cross, I can put my faith and trust in him. And so the judgment that was meant for me gets poured out on him. The righteousness that is his gets put on me. And then when we arrive at the glorious throne, Jesus doesn't look at me and say, now, Matt, now tell me all the good things you did. Tell me how hard you worked. Tell me how sweet you were to your wife. Tell me what good job you did with your kids. Tell me about all the sermons you preached. Jesus doesn't care about any of that. He's going to say, were you in me, trusting in me? Did you put your faith in me to pay for your sin? Because judgment either falls on me at the cross, which is the prepayment, or it falls on you now at the end of time. You have to make your decision. You got to make a choice, right? So that's how judgment works. And it's not simply an Old Testament idea. It is clearly something that Jesus is using the Old Testament to point to the future. In verse 20, there's going to be the establishment of a celebration. Or 20 through end of 9 and on into 10. There's this celebration that is created called Purim. Now, today, because of this book and because of this event, the Jews will celebrate Purim. This year, Purim will be March the 5th. So here's what would happen. If we were Jewish and we were celebrating, on March the 4th, we would fast. Just like Esther asked her family and friends to fast, we would fast for Esther because she's going to risk her life. So we would fast on the 4th. On the 5th, we would gather together and we'd hear the book read during the day. We'd hear the book read at night. Our kids would dress up, kind of like Halloween. Goes to a soccer game with noisemakers. And so when they would read the book, and whenever we get to Haman's name, we would all scream boo, and we would make noisemakers, and we would shout them down. And so that'd be part of the celebration. You don't seem like that seems that interesting to you. This is really cool. I'm trying to tell you something. And we would make food, and we would set aside some money, and we'd give money and food to our friends, and we'd give some money to the poor, and we would do that as part of the celebration, and here's the thing, mark this down. We would give them food as a, write this down, portion. And we would give away some money as a portion. And in just a second, I'll show you why. So that's part of that. That's part of what gets established right here, starting in verse 20. It says, so Mordecai recorded these events and sent letters to the Jews near and far throughout all the provinces of King Xerxes, calling on them to celebrate the annual festival on these 2 days. And he told them to celebrate these days with feasting, with gladness. Now, why feasting and gladness? Because we're celebrating. Why? Because that's the nature of judgment. We came out on the salvation side. We have something to be thankful for. By giving of food and other presents to the poor. This would commemorate a time when the Jews gained what? Relief. Is that we would share these gifts, this food, this feasting, because we gained relief from our enemies. And when the sorrow was turned into gladness and mourning turned into joy. So here's what you got to get. They were doomed, and now they're not. They had no future and no life, and then they were saved. And they do have a future and a life. They were going to die, and now they're going to live. Their children were going to be cut off, and now their children are going to grow up. And they weren't going to have any grandchildren, but now they are going to have grandchildren. And they weren't going to be able to live in peace, and now they are going to be able to live in peace. And it is marking them. It is marking the way they think. It is marking the way they believe. It's even marking the way they feel. They did not earn this. It was granted to them, although they did have to fight to fulfill, to bring that grant into real life and to bring it into fruition. But it was granted to them. And so now they have life in front of them and they're starting to think about life in a new way and they're starting to have to live in the future based on something that's happened in the past. This moment, these 2 days of salvation, now are starting to shape the way they think about the future, the way they feel about each other, the way they feel about God, how they act, how they live, how they respond to things. All of that is being shaped in this moment. They're now starting to live in light of this salvation moment for them. Verse 23. So the Jews accepted Mordecai's proposal and adopted the annual custom. Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had plotted to crush and destroy them. Notice this. He will not leave this part out. On the date determined by casting lots. The lots were called Purim. He said, if you don't remember this long-standing enemy that Saul should have handled a long time ago, and if Saul had obeyed God as the first king, then we wouldn't even be in this fix. But that's another sermon for another day. King should obey God. We should obey God. But this long-standing enemy picked the day that he would kill us by casting lots or throwing dice, let's say. So he threw the dice, he cast lots, and he cast the pur down, plural pur, purim. He threw the multiple dice down to try to find the right day, and it was March 7th. He found the day. So our lot, our portion, the word goes from being lot, die cast, creating your lot, your result. And that word morphs into the idea, takes on the word, the idea of portion. So when you cast the lots, when you throw the die down, they come up, snake eyes or whatever. That's your what? That's your lot. That's your portion. So when you cast the die, and he said, March 7th is your portion. That's the day you're going to die. And as it turns out, March 7th becomes the day when they don't die. It becomes the day when they live. So this book is about their portion. And so big idea is this. You go, what's the big idea of this book? Here's the big idea of this book. It is not evil men who throw dice who decide your portion. It is a benevolent, all-knowing, all-powerful God who gives you your portion. Which is very helpful when you have a bad boss. Right? Is that it is not my boss who gives me my portion. It is not my boss who decides March 7th is the last day of my job. It's not what my boss does. It is God who gives the portion. Now, there are dark days, and I don't like the way they're going. I have a hard time rationalizing the fact that it's a sovereign good God when he lets me suffer. But this book teaches it is not an evil king who decides my portion. It is an all-knowing, all-living, all-powerful God who sees and who can reverse that situation anytime he wants. But he is the one who decides my portion. So then you go back to March 5th this year. March 4th, you fast. March 5th, you celebrate Purim. You yell and scream every time they read Haman's name. And then you go give to the poor and to your friends. You give them what? A portion. You go, look what God gave me. He gave me a portion, and now I give you a portion. Even in the celebration, there's generosity. God's been so generous and kind to me that we're going to be generous and kind to other people, the poor, our friends, our family. God's given us a portion. We're going to give you a portion. It is a fascinating, fascinating idea to me how all this is woven together. But here's the practical piece too. If this is true, it's not the evil men who throw dice, but it is God who gives my portion. My belief in that is tested every time something does not go my way. My response to things that don't go my way determines who I think is throwing the dice. The anxiety level that I feel when things don't go my way in my home, at work, circumstances in life, the number of bills that come in, this unfortunate circumstance, this chronic illness, then the anxiety level that I feel, the stress that I feel, the anger that I feel, the panic that I feel, the need to control things tells you who I believe is throwing dice. Is it evil men throwing dice? Is it a random universe that happens by chance? And who would know? How could you control any of this? Or is there a sovereign God who is leading and controlling all of this? And he doesn't feel compelled to give me answers to stuff that's difficult for me. But that my stress level, my anxiety, tells you what I think about who's running the universe. Even if I know to say the right answer. Just because I can say the right answer of who's running the universe doesn't mean I actually believe it. And that's just for you. And preachers like me, we don't need to listen to this, but you do, right? Verse 29. Before we go any further and indict myself anymore, let's move on. It's the luxury you have when you're teaching. You're like, oh, I'm tired of making myself feel bad. Let's go to the next verse, 29. Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote another letter putting the queen's full authority behind Mordecai's letter to establish the festival of Purim. Letters wishing peace and security were sent to the Jews throughout 127 provinces of the empire of Xerxes. What have they done? They've created a disciplined way to remember. This is their version of knick-knack. Right? All the knick-knacks that I keep, all the little things that I keep to remind me. Because what will happen is their heart will wander. And in one generation, two generations, 10 generations, they'll begin thinking, you know how we got out of that deal in Persia? Esther was so smart. That's how we got out. You know how we made all that work? How that reversal happened with Xerxes and Haman? Mordecai, fearless. Mordecai wasn't afraid of anybody. He crafted this plan. He sent Esther in there. She was so beautiful. She's so talented. Nobody could keep up. She argued him into the ground, flipped the whole thing around. Mordecai's amazing. Esther is amazing. Random, chance, smart, talented, wealthy, enduring, powerful, clever, tricky, whatever. That's what we'll do. Second, third generation, 5 generations, 10 generations. Well, at some point we'll be like, you know what? I mean, who can stop us? We're amazing. We're that good. I mean, let 2 or 3 things go right for you. You hit 3 green lights in a row around Christmas. You're like, I must be all powerful. I get across Woodruff Road in less than 20 minutes. I think I'm sovereign of the universe. Look at my powers. I made this happen. I mean, we will forget. You have to build in some disciplines. It's why this is like reading the scriptures, prayer, fellowship, community, confession, repentance, even symbols. Times where you gather your family and you remember. Whether, you know, you can do some of that at Thanksgiving, Christmas. We have markers where you take time, you carve out devotions, where you say, okay, this is where I'm carving out time out of my day to be a part of what God wants. I'm going to worship Him, glorify Him, and get my heart right because I give all my day to energy producing for myself. I need to be remembered. When I give money not because God needs it, to remind me of the fact that all the money that I have, He gave me. I'm only giving back what? A portion of the bigger portion. When I give my time to serve someone, what am I doing? I'm giving them what? I'm giving them a portion because He's given me a huge portion. So I'm just giving them a small portion because she needs her porch fixed. So I'm going to fix her porch. Or that dude needs $50 because he's hungry. Or I want to be a part of what God's doing in the local church. So I'm going to give $200 a month. Or I'm going to go down, I'm going to make this long drive and help them find a car because they don't know how to buy a car. I'm going to give them some expertise, show them how to get insurance. I'm going to give a portion of what I have to someone else. So they're going to be a reminder. And I was in the most interesting conversation. There's a rash of us in our church that have lost our parents, particularly dads, in the last 6 months. I mean, it's like a rash of us. And so I was talking to one of those guys this week. And it's a very complicated situation, maybe the most complicated I've ever heard. Just a difficult family situation. And at the end of it, I mean, we're both crying. And he said, you know, but then I think, I'm like, look at my life. It's so complicated. But now I look at my life now. And I look at my original family and how complicated that was and how difficult. And some of it still is. And now I look at my life and I say, look at what God has done. And look how blessed I am. And then I think to myself, I'm the sole survivor. And I lean forward. I was like, sole survivor. He goes, God has saved one. Maybe he saves others. But up to this point, He's only saved one. He saved me. And if you could see the look in His face when He says, I'm the sole survivor, you would know. That is so deep in his soul. It marks the way he thinks. It marks the way he treats his wife and his children. It marks the way he works. It marks his integrity. It marks the way he's generous. It marks everything about him because something deep in his soul has happened that he could not do for himself that God did for him. I'm the sole survivor. Is that personal and that real to him? It changes the way you think about life when God rescues you. Chapter 10, verse 1. Let's celebrate the king. King Xerxes imposed a tribute throughout his empire, even to the distant coastlands. His great achievements and the full account of his greatness of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, are recorded in the book of the history of the kings of Media and Persia. Verse 3, Mordecai the Jew became prime minister. Check this. Lowly dude has now been exalted with authority. How high? Next to the king, Xerxes himself. He was very great among the Jews, who held him in high esteem. Why? Because he continued to work for the good of his people and to speak up for the welfare of all their descendants. So who's he good to? He's good to the king. Does the king know God? No. But he's good to the king. He's good to his people. He's found a way to make a contribution. So there's a reversal for everybody. A reversal for Esther. A reversal for Haman. A reversal for Mordecai. A reversal for the people. Guess who doesn't get a reversal? The king. But here's what we get. We get a reversal in the way we view him. Because the first, it's a book, it's called A Chiastic Construction, so it mirrors itself. The front of the book mirrors the end of the book, and it steps all the way down till there's a centerpiece. And so this mirrors the very first few verses of the book where it exalts the king, 127 provinces. He's amazing, he's wonderful, he rules the world. It's exalting of him. It's exalting of him here. But when you first read those first few verses, what do you get? He's awesome, he's in charge of the world. And when you read these verses, it extends it even to the coastlines, and he's so amazing. When you read it now, what do you think? You're like, well, I mean, he's a king, but there's someone else running the show. When you first read it, you're like, he's the king, he runs the show. And now when you read it, you're like, he's the king, he doesn't run the show. Someone else runs the show. That's what the book teaches you all the way through. In the beginning, you're like, oh my gosh, he's the king. Whew, big deal. Now you're like, gosh, he's the king, he doesn't run the show. Somebody else pulling levers, pulling strings. He's a part of it, but he is not running it. We celebrate him in a different way. The non-visible power has driven this whole story. Let me give you three things to think about, a couple things to think about. First of all, if you're not a Christian, what I would invite you to do is counterintuitive. I would invite you to consider the reversal nature of the world. I'm going to say, if you'll think about it, you can get there. I'm going to say this without really supporting it, is that nothing is what it seems to be. Nothing is what it seems to be. And if you'll take some time and think about it, there's enough evidence to support that. You got to think about it. You got to look closely. So this world is not the ultimate world. If it was, you wouldn't be able to imagine another one. Right? Because why is it you're so frustrated about things not going well? Like murder and injustice and rape and crime. Why does that bother you? If this is the only world you've ever known and those are things that have always been a part of it, then why are we frustrated with that? It just is what it is. But you know there's another world, and it's bigger and it's better than this one. So this one's not going to exist. It looks like it's the only thing, but there's another thing. There's something in your soul that tells you you should be the king, that everybody should revolve around you. And I'm telling you, that's not true. What your soul is doing, it's warring against the true king. The creator of the universe that wants you to worship him. And the fact that you want everybody to worship you and honor you lets you know there's something deviant that's broken, when really that all that worship is supposed to be directed towards someone else. And the fact that your soul is inclined towards brokenness and sin because it feels like freedom. It feels like liberty. When in fact, sin is bondage. It's not liberty. When you get all the freedom you want, it'll end in your destruction. There's so much reversal in this world. If you think about it for a short amount of time, you'll get there. And that Jesus, though he seems irrelevant because he's a baby in a manger, and we're going to talk about Santa Claus, and we're going to open gifts, and we're going to be so consumeristic, materialistic, Jesus is completely marginalized, when in reality, he's the ultimate reality. He's not marginalized at all. In Philippians says, every knee shall bow, and every tongue will confess. We'll all bow before him. It's something to think about. And then if you're a Christian, this book gives you comfort that God sees you. And he sees you in the situation you're in, and he will deliver you and he will rescue you at some point. It might be in this life or it might be in the next one. But until then, he has brought justice to your sin. He has prepaid the payment for your sin on the cross. So when we get to the end of the time, Jesus doesn't have to ask you about how you lived. He just moves you over with the sheep because you are in him and your sin is paid for. And you don't have to give an account for what you did right and what you did wrong, because it doesn't matter anyway. So it's great comfort that he's brought justice to your sin, and he's not compromised who he is and brought rest to your soul. And then in a minute, we're going to take communion. Let me show you this verse from 2 Corinthians 5:21. He made him, God made Jesus, who knew no sin, to be sin on our behalf so that we might become the righteousness of God in him. This verse is all about reversal. He made him who knew no sin, Jesus, to be sin so that those of us who know sin could have sin taken off of us. The last thing I am is righteous, and he has made me righteous in him. The last thing Jesus is sinful, and he's placed my sin on him. It's the ultimate reversal, and it's so ironic So we come to this table. It's the blood that I don't shed. It's the blood Jesus shed for me. It's the body, not that's my body broken. It's his body broken for me. It's a complete reversal. Who knew the book of Esther would teach us all about Jesus and drive us to him? Let's worship. Father, we're grateful that you speak from ancient times into our so sophisticated modern souls. Is that you have medicine that is good for us and it is timeless. That you have poured out the life of Jesus for us to give us life in our death. You care enough to go through the ultimate sacrifice for us. And we are grateful. We tell you that we love you. We know that there are things in our souls that are undiscovered. And we need you to pull back the veil so we can see clearly who you are, what you want for us. Where we have strayed from you and where we've hardened our hearts, cause us to confess and repent and turn towards you before it is too late. We ask for your grace and for your wisdom for all those that would put their faith and trust in you as an atonement, as a substitute for the judgment that is on us for our sin. We ask for your grace and your mercy. In Jesus' name.